welcome to this week's edition of the talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway, and this is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday, 22nd of February, 2020. Music this week is by the amazing and unique AKA Trio, comprising Antonio Forcione on guitar, Sekou Keita on the African Kora, and Adriano Adovale on percussion. So that's an Italian, Senegalese, Brazilian fusion. It's kind of folk jazz bossa nova, if you like. The track I'm playing is Barracoa from their newly released album Joy. I saw them perform recently at Cecil Sharp House, usually thought of as the home of English folk music. So this was something of a break with convention, but then folk is a broad church these days. They were very pleased to contribute this track to Talking Newspapers royalty-free, for which we are very grateful. As usual, I'll play the track in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, followed by suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Wendy, who has kindly stepped in to take over from Sue. In part two, Rob Pearman and Claire Hubber discuss A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. And in part three, we have a fascinating article from Hearts Life, in which former Hearts County Councillor Amanda King talks about our involvement with Extinction Rebellion. We start with the news, and our readers today are Caroline, Kelly, Bob, and Anne.
Hello, I'm Caroline. Our first story today is about a Harpenden teacher who channeled her grief from three family tragedies into a positive outcome, who wants to share her story to inspire and motivate other people in a similar situation. Claire Gillis is a busy 42-year-old mum of two and part-time teacher, whose love of cooking proved to be her salvation in the face of personal loss. Her story begins in July 2016, when her dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer. When you're faced with such a diagnosis, you feel helpless as there is nothing that you can do. You can't make things better, and it's difficult to know how to help. I decided I would use my love of cooking to help my parents. I began to take meals around. This not only lightened my mum's workload, but it also showed them how much I cared and gave me the opportunity for regular visits. I also continued to host regular family get-togethers, something I've always done, but with my dad's diagnosis, it seemed even more important that we got together as a family. I've always cooked from scratch, but my dad's illness made me start to think about how important what we eat is. It made me more determined to limit the amount of processed food I put on the table. I decided to start Facebook and Instagram pages to share tips, hints, recipes, and inspiration with others. I wanted to show how easy it is to cook from scratch. Sadly, her dad passed away in February 2017, shortly after his 70th birthday. But he became Claire's motivation and drive, and she continued on her mission to inspire others to ditch processed food and start from scratch. But then, that December, she received the heartbreaking news that her older brother had also been diagnosed with terminal cancer. Once I had processed what was happening and dealt with all the questions in my head, why us? How can life be so unfair? What have we done to deserve this? I once again used my love of cooking to help me with my grief and support my brother and his family. I cooked lunch for the two of us each Tuesday, and we ate it together and chatted, valuable time that I am so glad we shared. I would also get things ready for dinner that evening so that my brother could sit down with his wife and children and eat a home-cooked meal. It's times like these when it's all too easy to grab a processed meal from the supermarket. My time and cooking was such a small thing, but it meant so much to us all. Claire lost her brother in July 2018, aged just 49, but again she channeled her grief in a positive way. I decided that I would turn my social media presence into something else. I started on a journey to publishing a website packed with my simple home-cooked recipes that even the most reluctant cook could manage. My plan was to offer a subscription service at minimal cost, to show others that planning meals leads to healthier choices and saves money, and to demonstrate that cooking from scratch isn't complicated. But then, last August, tragedy struck again when her other brother suddenly died of a heart attack at the age of 47. There was no warning and no time to say goodbye. It really makes you realise how precious life is and how you have to make the most of the time you have. None of us know what's around the corner, but I want to give my family the best possible chance of a long and healthy life. By cooking from scratch every night, I'm teaching my children good habits that will hopefully stay with them into adulthood. But it's not just about my family. I want others to follow my lead and plan home-cooked meals. And I want to show people that by channeling your grief, you can have a positive impact, not only on yourself, but also on others.
Hello, my name's Anne, and this article is a news feature by Carolyn Thane, who investigated the question, does the county's Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, CAMHS, provide the support needed by our most vulnerable young people? A mum battling cancer has told how she fears her teenage daughter or herself will die before receiving the help their family needs from local child mental health services. The 53-year-old from Cotton Mill in St Albans was recently diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, which has spread and is fearing the worst after years of trying to get suitable support from NHS professionals for her 16-year-old. Although she is undergoing gruelling chemotherapy to try to stall the cancer, she is awaiting further test results to determine her prognosis. The mum of two quit her job in a school to care full time for the teen, who was in and out of inpatient psychiatric care amid several psychotic episodes, repeatedly running away from home and taking multiple attempts on her life. She has, quote, lost count of the number of times her daughter C has taken an overdose, gone to hospital to see the mental health team, and been told she is fine and sent home. The former teaching assistant said, both of us on all these occasions have begged for her to be admitted to a mental health unit for her own safety, but were always sent home. It was so destroying for everyone. C was repeatedly discharged from hospital without sufficient measures in place, and on one occasion she took an overdose the night she was released from a local inpatient unit. Then CAMHS workers said it wasn't safe for follow-up care meetings to be done at the family home because of violent outbursts from C. Yet one particular suicide attempt led to a 3-day admission, resulting in a diagnosis which C has found helpful. Still struggling, she is at home and has an allocated child mental health worker, but she is not well enough to attend school and receives educational support to try to get her through GCSEs in maths and English. But her mother insists that the only way they got any help at all was through her perseverance and strong advocating. Now the worried mum is terrified time might run out for her or her daughter, as a large tumour in her lungs, which has spread to her lymph nodes, threatens to separate them. She said, I've a whopping tumour, too big to operate on. When the fear hits, and it's kicking in at the moment, my thoughts are very dark. I've a deep suspicion that the news is going to be bad. When I was told that my tumour is the biggest size grading, I just switched off. I had expected them to say it was small. I couldn't take it in, and they said they'd give me a written report, so I just zoned out. But I'm horribly practical, and I read, so I am very aware my chances are not good. Will I have time to get my family in a good place? She explained how a new CAMHS worker said she had read all the notes, but did not appear to know any of the specifics, including that her daughter was meant to be seen in the hospital cafe. The former CAMHS worker was happy to meet C in the cafe, and the new worker wasn't aware of that, because a handover that was meant to have taken place did not. She said, It's like they have had all common sense and empathy surgically removed. I shouldn't have to explain the basics to a paid, experienced professional. But that's CAMS for you. They don't know how to do it, and occasionally you can get one that can. And then they disappear, moved to a different area, leaving their service users to start all over again with a new worker who, chances are, is rubbish. They run a very service-orientated service, which is not flexible unless you kick up a fuss. If the user doesn't do what they provide, they're dumped and accused of refusing to engage. Like attending group therapy, for example. But many of these kids are not well enough to attend group therapy. It shows a deep misunderstanding of mental health and makes it hard for anyone to engage with their very limited provision. The mum also blames a lack of national standardisation, passing the buck to other agencies, and the postcode lottery nature of varying provision as key failings. Sentiments echoed by many local parents of mentally unwell children. In desperation, the mum contacted the old worker, who has agreed to advise the new worker, and now C is on a 6-month waiting list to go back under the caseload of the old worker again. C is due to have autism testing soon, and a recent diagnosis and medication have led to fewer psychotic episodes, less self-harm and suicidality. She added, "Things are better, but still a long way from safe. We've learned so much, and she has too. But the fear is always there for all of us that she'll tip back into crisis. I'm sure the stress hasn't helped my health. It will be interesting to see how CAMS cope with the challenge of my illness in terms of the impact on my child's mental health. They don't support parents or siblings. There are so many problems to sort out. I'm going to discuss with my Macmillan nurse how best to prepare my husband and children. I just hope I will have time to sort it all out before I become too unwell."
Hello, I'm Bob. This headline reads, "Campaign to protect community meadow quashed by developers." Planning permission has been granted allowing horses to graze on a community meadow in St Albans, despite repeated objections from residents. Bedman Field, off Bedman Lane in St Albans, has been listed as an asset of community value since 2014, but its status expired in March last year. Developers Carla Homes made multiple attempts to challenge the meadow's protected status, and St Albans District Council's Planning Referrals Committee finally granted permission for a change of use of the land on Monday, February the 10th. The plan involves building a stable for a horse to be kept, along with two road accesses, one from Parklands Drive and the other from Main Avenue. Members of the Verulam Residents Association, who have long campaigned to protect the meadow, believe the application is the first step to allowing the Green Belt site to be developed into housing. Chair Tim Beecroft, who spoke at the meeting to oppose the application, said, "What is so frustrating is that the vast majority of the comments from the members of the planning committee clearly showed that they wanted to refuse the application, which they described as ridiculous and unsuitable." According to Mr. Beecroft, the committee were unable to refuse an application on that basis and found there was no valid reason for refusal under the planning policy. He said, "This case would seem to indicate that there are some pretty fundamental flaws in the way that the planning system works. In St Albans, we also have the problem that we haven't yet got an agreed local plan which sets out the framework within which decisions like this should be taken. There is much uncertainty, but one thing that is certain is that the Verulam Residents Association will continue to do its best to ensure that the residents' voices are heard to the greatest possible effect. The campaigners were working on an application to have the Meadows Asset of Community Value status extended, but found it was almost impossible to do so, as the owner of an ACV can close off the area to the public. After the field was made into an ACV, Carla Holmes fenced off all of the meadow apart from two footpaths and put up notices saying, "Private land, no unauthorised access." There's a picture of the lovely Bedman Meadow with the gorse trees and Mayflower and such like.
My name is Kelly, and my article is titled "Conservation Area Pub Calls Time on Trading." An iconic pub in St Albans Conservation Area has closed its doors and drawn the curtains. The Rose and Crown in St Michael Street has shut after leaseholder Richard Moret handed the keys back to Punch Pubs after 3 years of running the business. The business was reportedly struggling to make money despite investing in improvements such as an upgrade of the beer garden and serving food. Richard said, "We are very disappointed to close the Rose and Crown after 3 great years. We are grateful to all our supporters and regulars over the past few years. My particular thanks to the great team of staff." A spokesperson for the Campaign for Real Ale, whose headquarters are in Hatfield Road, lamented the loss of another one of the city's pubs. He said, "Pubs in St Albans have come under increasing pressures due to, amongst other things, business rates. We hope that the Rose and Crown will reopen as soon as possible, as it is one of the iconic pubs in our city." A spokesperson for Save St Albans Pubs said, "Our independent landlords are fighting to survive in an industry that is overtaxed and in a tough near-recessionary economy." The loss of yet another much-loved community pub, the Rose and Crown, reflects how much at risk our industry is. One in every £3 spent in pubs goes to the taxman, whether beer duty, business rates or VAT. Without urgent action from the government, our community pubs, owned by hard-working local landlords who put their heart and soul into making a pub like the Rose and Crown a special, welcoming environment, will continue to close. It's time for the government to support the industry. Once a pub is gone, it's gone. Chairman of St Albans Civic Society, Tim Boatswain, said, "We are very worried about this, as it is such a big part of our culture. The cause of the problem is business rates, and the government needs to give some relief, or we are going to see more pubs closing down. We have already lost 2 pubs in Fishpool Street. Neighbouring pubs, the Blue Anchor and the Black Lion, were both converted into homes for the same reasons in the last decade."
This is an article about how schools ditched plastic milk cartons to help the environment. Pupils at a Harpenden Infant School took matters into their own hands after seeing the amount of single-use plastics they were wasting. Now, Crabtree Infant School has changed the way school milk is received to help the environment. Eco-teacher Andrea Bootle explained, "Every Friday our bins were overflowing with little milk cartons. Each child could get 5 of them a week, each with its own straw. And with 180 children in the infant school, even if only half of them had milk ordered for them, the maths was staggering. 90 children, 5 cartons a week, 39 weeks a year, that's 17,550 little cartons and straws to landfill a year. The children loved getting their milk, but the waste upset them, so we looked at options for recycling the cartons. But since many still contained liquid, we couldn't see a sensible way to deal with the waste. With adding in all the plastic shrink wrap, the waste was extraordinary." The pupils wrote to the school's designated milk provider, who offered them an alternative supply of reusable plastic beakers and large containers of milk instead of individual cartons. "Obviously, we were nervous at first. We had visions of milk flooding all over the carpet if they used open beakers. However, all the staff have been amazing and the children have coped with it well." Reception teacher Georgia Frost said, "The children in reception enjoy socialising at the snack table. They have gained independence by pouring their own milk whilst being eco-friendly. It allows them to take some responsibility for the whole world around them, something we encourage in all aspects of school life." Andrea added, "The children were so right to challenge what we do. Their determination has saved thousands of cartons and straws from ending up in landfill. I'm extremely proud of them. Now the team behind St Albans Sustainability Festival is using Crabtree's example to encourage teachers from all over the district to get involved in this year's Schools Week, which is running from June the 1st to the 5th as part of the wider two-week event. SusFest has a schools working group with representatives from a number of local organisations, as well as climate education specialists and enthusiasts from across the district. This year, London Colney Schools are organising a walk to school week. Samuel Ryder Academy is using plastic bottles to build a school greenhouse. Fleetville Infants is holding an eco week. And Abbey CEVA Primary School is working on its outdoor learning environment.
This news article is entitled Marathon Man Joins Harpenden Junior School as Part of Daily Mile. Marathon man Ben Smith has visited a Harpenden Junior School to celebrate the county's success with national campaign The Daily Mile. Instrumental in encouraging schools to adopt the concept of taking children outside to run or jog for 15 minutes per day, The Daily Mile allows pupils to take part in their uniform at any time of day, in any weather, and is fully inclusive to all children. The visit marked Crabtree Junior School becoming the 200th primary school in Harts to register for the initiative. Ben, who famously completed 401 marathons in 401 days, presented a morning assembly to pupils and staff, during which he described his own experiences of using running as a means of countering mental health issues. His inspirational talk touched on bullying, respect for others, and following one's own dreams in life, an ethos the school proudly follows. Ben visited more than 10 primary schools last week, spoke at an inaugural secondary school conference, and shared his story with scores of college students during his stay. The week was organised by the Harts Sports and Physical Activity Partnership. Crabtree Junior's head teacher Emma Simmons said, "The day was incredible for our pupils. From the moment the children walked into the hall, the air of excitement was overwhelming. We are so very proud to welcome Ben and hear his story, coupled with celebrating our status as the 200th school to register for the Daily Mile." She added, "Since we started taking part in the Daily Mile, the difference the staff report in the children's ability to concentrate is tremendous. The school has a key focus on the mental health and well-being of our pupils, and we feel rewarded by our efforts by Ben's visit. His inspiring story of overcoming adversity sends an important message about resilience and determination to everyone." Councillor Annie Brewster, Harts County Council Executive Deputy Member for Public Health and Prevention, said, "I am delighted Crabtree School has joined the impressive list of 200-plus Hertfordshire primary schools who are taking part in the Daily Mile. Not only is it a perfect initiative to develop a daily physical fitness routine, but it is also a tremendous boost for good mental health, appealing to pupils of all abilities. We still have 33 schools in St Albans District who have not yet signed up, and we're very keen to help them overcome any obstacles preventing them from doing so." And the article is accompanied by a lovely photograph of the children outside the school with Ben Smith and Annie Brewster.
Air pollution is responsible for 1 in 18 deaths among people aged 30 or over in Hertfordshire, new data reveals. The environmental charity Friends of the Earth says levels of damaging air pollution across the country are an absolute disgrace and has called for new legally enforceable reduction targets. Public Health England figures show an estimated 5.6% of deaths of people aged 30 or over in Hertfordshire in 2018 were caused by air pollution. The data measures deaths associated with long-term exposure to tiny particles known as PM2.5, which have a diameter about 3% of the width of a human hair. Vehicle emissions are a major source of the harmful particles, which are also produced by industrial processes and the burning of fuels for heating. Repeated exposure can trigger chronic diseases such as asthma, heart disease, or bronchitis, and cause other respiratory problems. Across England, 5.2% of deaths of people aged 30 or over were estimated to be due to this type of air pollution in 2018. Jenny Bates, a campaigner for the environmental charity Friends of the Earth, said, "These levels of the most health-damaging air pollution are an absolute disgrace. Every year, UK air pollution causes nearly 36,000 early deaths and billions of pounds in costs to the economy. The government must get a grip on this health crisis." Ms. Bates added that the new environmental bill was a crucial opportunity to protect healthy air by setting out legally binding targets on particle air pollution to be met by 2030. Councillor David Renard, the local government association's transport spokesman, said councils have introduced a range of measures to tackle air pollution, such as clean air zones, encouraging the use of electric vehicles with recharging points, and promoting cycling. But he warned that any air quality plans need proper funding and local flexibility to be successful. He added, "Local powers are also needed to further tackle air pollution, particularly with regard to moving traffic offences, and robust national action to help the country transition to lower emission travel, including cycling and walking, and an effective national bus strategy."
Adults with learning disabilities will be hit by respite closures. Adults with learning disabilities may be left without respite care after a County Council panel voted to recommend the closure of centres in St Albans, Hemel Hempstead and Bishop Stortford. In a meeting of Herts County Council's Adult Care and Health panel on February the 7th, the group, Carers in Hertfordshire, presented a petition signed by more than 1,500 people against the closures. The three respite centres under threat are Hicksbury Lane in St Albans, Chewin Road in Hemel Hempstead and Apton Road in Bishop Stortford. The petition was launched by St Albans mum, Jackie Wilkes, who has a 26-year-old daughter with learning disabilities, along with her husband Andrew and fellow mum Sharon Shepherd, who also has a daughter with learning disabilities the same age. Members of the panel voted against the petition and the Cabinet will now make the final decision on February the 24th. Councillor Nigel Benn, Deputy Leader of the County Labour Group, said, "It was very dispiriting to see seven Conservative members vote to close the three respite centres. We had listened to Jackie Wilkes argue persuasively for a service that works collectively with users for their needs while trying to be cost effective. It became clear that many families do not have the full facts about respite care availability and that it should be better publicised." Liberal Democrats also spoke against the closures, including leader of St Albans District Council, Councillor Chris White. He said, "Chewin Road and Hicksbury Lane both have usage in excess of 80% and high levels of user satisfaction. Closing them makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, and a glance at the map of service users show how many will be seriously affected by the closure of these units." Councillor Richard Roberts, the County Council's Executive Member for Adult Care and Health, said, "Our current short break services are not fully used, so we have made proposals to reduce the overall number of centres by making better use of all those we have. We will continue to offer the same level of support for people currently using the service. We are committed to working with people who need respite services to help us improve and develop them so they are fit for the future."
An apprentice from St Albans was invited to the House of Commons for the 4th Annual Hospitality Apprenticeship Showcase. Alfie Kavanagh, chef apprentice at the Blackberry Jack in St Brailead's Place, met local MP Daisy Cooper, who commended his contribution to hospitality and his part in changing the perception of the industry. The Hospitality Apprenticeships Showcase displays the vibrant pub, bar, brewing, hotel and casual dining sectors and aims to highlight the job opportunities available to young people, as well as challenging the negative perception of careers in the hospitality industry. The reception saw more than 200 representatives from the hospitality industry and MPs from across the UK come together to celebrate the burgeoning sector, lifted up by the dedication of young apprentices thriving within the companies that they work.
This article, entitled "A St Albans Photographer Has Achieved International Recognition for Her Work," Annie Griggs, a multiple award-winning photographer based in St Albans, has won the Guild of Photographers Image of the Year competition. The Guild of Photographers is a highly regarded national photographic body whose members are dedicated to enhancing their skills in the art, craft and profession of photography. During 2019, the competition attracted over 13,500 entries worldwide. Annie's image was selected as the overall Image of the Year winner of the baby and toddler category. The award was presented at the Guild's awards night at Crewe Hall in Cheshire. Director of the Guild, Leslie Thirsk, said, "I am both proud and delighted that Annie Griggs has achieved this recognition with their striking image. Annie quite rightly should be delighted with their extraordinary achievement." And the article is accompanied by a small photo of Annie receiving her award, together with a copy of the original photo of a lovely red-headed toddler sitting on a rug.
A partnership supporting the St Albans Abbey to Watford Junction line has received the official seal of approval from the government. The Abbey Line Community Rail Partnership has become one of the first partnerships in the country to be awarded an official accreditation by the Department for Transport, following a process that looked at how the partnership is run, how it uses funding, and how it benefits the community it serves. Executive Member for Growth, Infrastructure, Planning and the Economy, Derek Ashley, said, "The award recognises the hard work that our members have put in over the years and the fantastic response we have had from local people along the line. Importantly, it also means that the Abbey Line Community Rail Partnership is able to apply for government funding to help deliver even more projects to improve the line and encourage more people to use this local rail service." The Abbey Line Community Rail Partnership was established in June 2005 and brings together a number of partner organisations with the purpose of increasing usage of the line. It also aims to enhance station environments to make them a more pleasant place and to give the community the opportunity to become more involved in their railway line.
20 is plenty is message for motorists passing school. Pupils have been urging drivers to slow down outside their school. Children from Camp Primary and Nursery School reminded motorists to keep to the 20 mile per hour speed limit as part of a day of action last Friday. 6 months ago, the new 20 miles per hour limit was introduced along Camp Road, and the children wanted to make posters to encourage drivers to slow down. Also on the day, Councillor Anthony Rowlands gave the school its Silver School Travel Award, a national scheme recognising the work of schools and encouraging sustainable travel. Cyclists from years 5 and 6 also received their bikeability certificates after learning how to ride safely. Camp head teacher Sharon Barton said, "We're very proud of the way our pupils, school governors and staff continue to work together to get these important messages across and make the area around our school a safer one." and there's a picture with a 20 mile per hour speed limit sign accompanied by the children and their posters.
St Albans twins will be celebrating their third birthday this leap year. Identical twins Jessie and Rosie Nelson were born on February the 29th, 2008, and will be 12 years old. But due to their leap year birth, it will only be their third birthday. The girls, who go to Beaumont School, celebrated their first birthday in 2012 and their second birthday in 2016. Dad Jamie Nelson, 44, of Salisbury Avenue, St Albans, said the girls normally celebrate over 2 days, February the 28th and March the 1st, but this year they will celebrate on their real birthday. They'll be playing football on the morning and having a party at Zorb Football in the afternoon at London Colney with their friends. Jamie said it makes it much more special for them on a leap year birthday because it's their actual birthday. It is great that girls' football is growing so much. I'm really proud of the girls. They were born a minute apart. They're close but have different personalities, which is fascinating. And there's a lovely picture of the twins.
Once more with folk music legend Felix. A folk music legend will be performing in Harpenden next week. Now in her 80s, singer, songwriter, humanitarian and environmentalist Julie Felix plays an intimate gig at Harpenden Public Halls on Wednesday, February the 26th. Julie arrived in England in 1964 after leaving California and hitching through Europe with the guitar her father, a Mexican Maharachi musician, had given her. It didn't take long before Julie took the seat as a resident singer on the amazingly popular TV show The Frost Report. She soon became a household name in the UK. 4 years after stepping on our shores, Julie was given her own TV series, Once More with Felix. Over 3 years, Julie presented more than 40 shows, and guests included Spike Milligan, Richard Harris, Leonard Cohen, Dusty Springfield, Donovan, Jimmy Page, and many more. Her career flourished through the 60s and 70s, with her music reflecting her heartfelt beliefs and her love affair with nature. Julie moved back to California in the 1980s and took a break from the music world. An experience on a peace march in Central America in the late 80s inspired Julie to pick up her guitar and start singing again. 2 decades later, in October 2013, Julie was invited to Buckingham Palace to meet the Queen, Prince Philip, Prince Charles and Camilla. And last April, she appeared on BBC Radio 2's The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe. A couple of months later, Julie was playing on the acoustic stage at Glastonbury, 30 years or so since performing on the theatre stage there for the first time. On the final day of the festival, Julie was one of the guests on BBC Radio 6's Mark Radcliffe Live from Glastonbury. DJ Mark had a chat with Julie and played Da Elva Leva, a song from Julie's latest album, Rock Me Goddess. What began for Julie as simple home entertainment, as her father and his friends played mariachi music into the small hours of the morning, has actually been this remarkable woman's vocation for half a century. You can see the legendary Julie Felix and support act Gabriel Moreno on Wednesday. The tickets are £16. Or you can call the box office on 01582 767 525.
There promises to be an entertaining evening for all football fans, but supporters of Tottenham Hotspur especially, when two of their most famous players visit St Albans. Steve Perryman and Ozzy Ardiles are heading to the Sandpit Theatre at Sandringham School on Monday, March the 9th, for what promises to be a unique blend of entertainment and football memories and nostalgia. The pair will be interviewed on stage by stadium presenter Paul Coit, recollecting on their experiences through their illustrious careers. And they aren't coming alone. As special guests for the evening will be Bobby Davro and Dave Peacock, one half of Chaz and Dave, who will look back on those Spurs classic FA Cup final songs, including Ozzy's Dream. Perryman, who played a club record 854 times for Tottenham between 1969 and 1986, said, "Me and Ozzy go back a long way and are really good friends. I wouldn't say we were a double act, but we bounce off each other. He is very funny. If I could make a joke in a foreign language, then I would be happy. Part of the way we get together now is through events like this, so they are always fun. It's going to be a good evening. Tickets are priced at £30 and can be purchased either by calling the box office on 01727 799565 or online at sandpittheatre.co.uk. And for Spurs fans, there's a picture of Steve Perryman with the FA Cup in 1982.
Pianist Ivan Rodriguez Deb will give the free lunchtime recital at St Peter's Church next week. He will be performing works by J.S. Bach, Beethoven and Brahms on Wednesday, February the 26th. 14-year-old Ivan began playing the piano at the age of 8 with Olwen Morris at Watford School of Music. Besides being a passionate pianist, Ivan also plays the cello, and his programme will include pieces by J.S. Bach and Fauré. Lunchtime music at the St Albans Church starts at 1 p.m.
Here are the radio listings from Saturday the 22nd to Friday the 28th of February. Now here is a selection of radio programmes for the coming week which you might enjoy. Starting with Saturday the 22nd of February. At 3 p.m. you can hear Sound of Cinema, which this week highlights film scores by Elmer Bernstein, including The Magnificent Seven, The Ten Commandments and The Great Escape. That's at 3 p.m. on Radio 3. If you prefer drama, at the same time on Radio 4 is The Man Who Would Be King, an adaptation of Rudyard Kipling's novel about two con men who set out to conquer a remote region of what is now Afghanistan. That's at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. At 5:30, we have The Bottom Line, in which Evan Davis tackles the topic of the working week. Would a shorter one improve productivity, help work-life balance, and address the threat of technology taking over some work roles? You can hear that at 5:30 on Radio 4. Finally, at 6:30, Opera from the Met features Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, his evergreen comic opera depicting the political and social clashes in 18th century Seville. That's at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3.
Moving on to Sunday the 23rd of February. At 3 p.m. there's the start of a new series of The Pallisers. It's the 1880s and Plantagenet is to become Prime Minister. He is in charge of the government, but Cora is determined to be the power behind the throne. Is she a force for good or just meddling? The Pallisers is at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. At 5:30, Words and Music this week is called Less is More. To mark the start of Lent later this week, Jane Lapaterre and John Heffernan read excerpts reflecting the power of miniatures, memories, absence and simplicity, including writings by Walt Whitman, Edgar Allan Poe and John Keats, with music by Haydn and Duke Ellington, among others. That's at 5:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Staying with Radio 3, at 7:30 p.m, the drama on 3 is The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams, which he based on his own life and family in St. Louis in the 1930s. The Glass Menagerie is at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3.
We now turn to some programmes which are broadcast at the same time throughout the week from Monday to Friday. Starting with the Book of the Week, which this week is The Crying Book by American poet Heather Crystal, in which she researches the act of crying, investigating the science and art of tears. Book of the Week is on Radio 4 every weekday at 9:45 a.m. and repeated at 12:30. At 10:45 a.m. is The Essay, The Art of Apology, in which poet Helen Mort explores the human impulse to apologise and looks at what people are seeking when they say sorry. That's at 10:45 a.m. on Radio 3. At the same time on Radio 4, you can hear The Quarry Wood by Nan Shepherd, set in the 1920s, in which Martha Ironside, born to a poor family in rural Deeside, grows up to gain a place at university, her achievement met with a mixture of hostility and pride by her friends and family. You can hear The Quarry Wood on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m. The composer of the week this week is Beethoven at 12 noon on Radio 3. At 12:04 p.m. is Asparagon, the new novel by Colin McCann, which is rooted in the real-life friendship between Palestinian Bassam Aramin and Israeli Rami Elhanan, who are united by the loss of their daughters in acts of violence. That's at 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated at 10:45 p.m. Finally, there are two dramas through the week on Radio 4 Extra. At 10 a.m, Ben-Hur is in four parts from Monday to Thursday. And at 6 p.m. is The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells.
Here are some individual programmes you can hear through the week. On Monday the 24th of February, at 11 a.m, the first episode of a new series of Out of the Ordinary is A Sense of Direction, in which Jolyon Jenkins asks, might humans have an inbuilt compass like homing pigeons? And if so, how can we discover it? A Sense of Direction is at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. At 3 p.m. is the start of a new series, Round Britain Quiz, in which this week a team from Scotland take on one from Wales. That's at 3 p.m. on Radio 4.
On Tuesday the 25th of February, at 11 a.m, if you haven't had enough of Brexit, you can hear The Insider Story of Election 19, in which Anne McElvoy talks to the key figures across the political spectrum about how the 2019 election was fought and lost, and explores to what extent it was a Brexit election. That's at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. In complete contrast, over on Radio 4 Extra, is A Year at the Races. Toby Jones stars as an iconic Hollywood comedian, Groucho Marx, in Neil Brand's comedy drama. A Year at the Races is at 11:15 a.m. on Radio 4 Extra. At 2:15, the crime drama series The Interrogation returns, with the first of three episodes running from Tuesday to Thursday. Today in Ross, detectives Mats and Sean interview a prisoner about an attack on a fellow inmate. That's at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Finally, at 3 p.m, we have Shortcuts, a programme called Dancing on the Radio. Josie Long presents a showcase of short documentaries about dancing at 3 p.m. on Radio 4.
And on Wednesday, the 26th of February, at 9 a.m. in Only Artists, playwright Simon Stevens meets poet laureate Simon Armitage to discuss creative questions, processes and decisions. Only Artists is at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, and repeated at 9:30 p.m. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 comes from Salford and features music by Russian composers. Spring and Summer from The Seasons by Glazunov and Symphony No. 6 in B minor by Tchaikovsky, known as the Pathetique. That's at 2 p.m. on Radio 3. Thinking Aloud at 4 p.m, which examines human behaviour, institutions and conventions, today looks at citizenship, and it can be heard at 4 p.m. on Radio 4. And finally, you can hear The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe at 9 p.m. on Radio 2.
Now to Thursday, the 27th of February. At 9 a.m, Melvyn Bragg's programme In Our Time this week looks at the evolution of the horse. That's at 9 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 9:30 p.m. At 3 p.m, Claire Balding's Ramblings joins Sikh-turned-Methodist Inderjeet Bogal, who had the idea of following a long-distance walking route that was part of the Wilberforce Way in East Yorkshire, created to honour the great slavery abolitionist. Inderjeet has an extraordinary story to tell. Born in Kenya, he and his parents fled via Tanzania to Dudley in the West Midlands in the early 1960s. Unable to find anywhere to practice his Sikh faith, he started attending his local Methodist chapel, going on to become a leading figure in the Methodist Church. Ramblings is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In the bottom line at 8:30 p.m, the programme looks at the UK housing shortage, especially in the social and private rental sector, and asks why more homes aren't being built. That's on Radio 4 at 8:30 p.m.
And so to Friday the 28th of February. At 11 a.m, a new series, Forum Internum, looks at freedom of thought and why it might need protecting in the digital age. With the growth of new technologies, among them AI and neuroscience, can the law prevent their misuse by corporations and by the state? Forum Internum is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. There's drama at 2:15 p.m. with the final instalment of the occasional romantic comedy about a couple who met on a train. In Where This Service Will Depart, Susie has taken the plunge and planned a surprise romantic reunion at Heathrow Airport with David as he leaves the country to start a new life in Chicago. But surprises don't always go to plan. That's at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Finally, to end the week, we have Friday Night is Music Night, presented by actor Warwick Davis, marking the 80th anniversary of the release of the film The Wizard of Oz in America. Larry Blank conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra in a celebration of Victor Fleming's 1939 masterwork, The Wizard of Oz, and the programme also includes Over the Rainbow and songs from the film The Wiz and stage musical Wicked, performed by West End stars. Friday Night is Music Night is at 8 p.m. on Radio 2. Enjoy your listening week.
It's time now for part two, in which Rob Pearman and Claire Hubber discuss A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles.
The last time that Claire Hubber was in the studio with me, we were talking about a book that she'd recommended called Milkman by Anna Burns, which of course was the winner for that year's Man Booker Prize. And this time Claire suggested that we look at A Gentleman in Moscow, which is a book I hadn't read. I've now not only read the book, but I've also listened to the audiobook, which is quite an interesting way of doing it. It's by an American author called Amor Towles. Is that right? T-O-W-L-E-S?
Yes, I believe Towles is the recommended pronunciation. And he is effectively American aristocracy, as close as they get in America to aristocracy, an old Boston family, then Ivy League University, then he became an investment banker, then he retired at an enviably early age to write fiction. And he has already had one previous bestseller called The Rules of Civility. I'm not sure whether it was a bestseller here, but possibly in the States. And what I find remarkable is how similar, really, his CV is to that of his hero and protagonist in A Gentleman in Moscow, Count Alexander Rostov, whose CV goes, recipient of the Order of St. Andrew, member of the Jockey Club, master of the hunt.
Yes, and of course the cultured nature of this man, Count Rostov, is very important to the tale. It sets out why he is in the situation that he's in when we start the book, but it also follows him all the way through because he's very well read. He's had a life of leisure. In the pre-revolutionary days, it was a life of parties and all the things that went with that. tell us how we start this book, because it actually starts in a strange way with a court transcript, because he's being tried in 1922, I think, by the Communist Party.
Clearly, the expectation in a time of such purges and so many executions is that a patently aristocratic man brought before this committee will not be coming out again alive. So we have a court transcript, and it seems that the reason in this trial that he is not executed is that he has done one good thing, which would make it, or good from the point of view of the Communist Party, which would make it very difficult to execute him. And he has authorship of a poem which appears to be inciting the revolution. So it's something that perhaps inspired revolutionaries and that they held dear to their heart. And this is attributed to our hero, Count Alexander Rostov. So he is not executed. He is instead condemned to house arrest, permanent house arrest. And his house, as it turns out to be, is the place where he is currently residing. The Metropole Hotel, a magnificent and very luxurious hotel right in the centre of Moscow, opposite the Bolshoi, close to the Kremlin. But all that will no longer be accessible to Count Rostov, for he is to remain indoors and never to come out again at pain of being shot.
At 6:30 on the 21st of June 1922, when Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov was escorted through the gates of the Kremlin onto Red Square, it was glorious and cool. Drawing his shoulders back without breaking stride, the Count inhaled the air like one fresh from a swim. The sky was the very blue that the cupolas of St. Basil's had been painted for. Their pinks, greens and golds shimmered as if it were the sole purpose of a religion to cheer its divinity. Even the Bolshevik girls conversing before the windows of the State Department store seemed dressed to celebrate the last days of spring. "Hello, my good man," the Count called to Fyodor at the edge of the square. "I see the blackberries have come in early this year." Giving the startled fruit seller no time to reply, the Count walked briskly on, his waxed moustaches spread like the wings of a gull. Passing through Resurrection Gate, he turned his back on the lilacs of the Alexander Gardens and proceeded toward Theatre Square, where the Hotel Metropole stood in all its glory. When he reached the threshold, the Count gave a wink to Pavel, the afternoon doorman, and turned with a hand outstretched to the two soldiers trailing behind him. "Thank you, gentlemen, for delivering me safely. I shall no longer be in need of your assistance."
Circumstances are not at all as they were when he left, from having one of the best suites in the hotel full of his favourite furniture and family memorabilia. He is consigned to a loft, a room that was previously reserved for servants, and with a low ceiling. He, we are told, is 6'3", and the ceiling doesn't really accommodate that. And it is a huge reduction in his circumstances. So although he has been given his life, he is not to spend it in the luxury that he has been used to. And I think this is the point where we first really see the call made on his character and his reserves. And it's quite a big call. He prides himself. He's very cultured. He has a huge reservoir of knowledge and education to call on. Also, a code of good behaviour and elegant behaviour, and a face that must be preserved under all circumstances. I think this is the code under which he lives. And this is now going to be a challenge. When you're being treated like a servant, can you behave like a count?
The crowded confusion of furniture gave the Count's little domain the look of a consignment shop in the Arbat. In a room this size, he could have made do with a single high-backed chair, a single bedside table, and a single lamp. He could have made do without his grandmother's Limoges altogether. "And the books?" "All of them," he had said with such bravado. But in the light of day, he had to admit that this instruction had been prompted less by good sense than by a rather childish impulse to impress the bellhops and put the guards in their place. For the books were not even to the Count's taste. His personal library of majestic narratives by the likes of Balzac, Dickens and Tolstoy had been left behind in Paris. The books the bellhops had lugged to the attic had been his father's, and, devoted as they were to studies of rational philosophy and the science of modern agriculture, each promised heft and threatened impenetrability.
And he sort of got used fairly quickly to the idea that his life of leisure would continue, albeit in a very small space.
Yes, I think immediately we see that he uses his ingenuity to make his situation in the servants' rooms as good as it can be. But after a time of living this leisured and frankly somewhat pointless life in a cramped space, he begins to lose his sense of himself and his motivation to go on living. After all, his whole class has been rendered pointless in Russia and to an extent wiped out or sent away to France. And within the hotel, similarly, he has an easy enough existence, but no point. So there's a particular episode which brings this to a head where he is attracted to a young actress who is passing through, and that passage where they become attracted to one another is crackling. It's very much worth reading. And she summons him to her room, but afterwards she dismisses him just as if he were of a lower order. And I think this forces a crisis, and he sees that he is no longer a person who is respected, who simply by his very being commands respect and has rank, and he begins to feel a little bit like a ghost.
Even if a person generally frowned upon rude and abrupt behaviour, under the circumstances he might have to admit a certain rough justice upon finding himself in an empty hallway with his shoes in his hand and his shirt untucked, as the woman he's just left falls soundly asleep. For, if a man has had the good fortune to be plucked from the crowd by an impetuous beauty, shouldn't he expect to be sent on his way without ceremony? Well, maybe so, but standing in the empty corridor, across from a half-eaten bowl of borscht, the Count felt less like a philosopher than a ghost. Yes, a ghost, thought the Count, as he moved silently down the hall. Like Hamlet's father roaming the ramparts of Elsinore after the midnight watch, or like Akaki Akakievich, that forsaken spirit of Gogol's, who, in the wee hours, haunted the Kalinkin Bridge in search of his stolen coat. Why is it that so many ghosts prefer to travel the halls of night? Ask the living, and they will tell you that these spirits either have some unquenched desire, or an unaddressed grievance that stirs them from their sleep and sends them out into the world in search of solace.
He has to pull himself together. He has a decision to take. One thing that is possible at the Metropole is taking his own life because he can get out onto the roof. In fact, that is the closest he ever comes to escaping his confinement, is the open space of the roof where he's under the sky and an elderly caretaker with his apiary of bees is also up there to provide more interest. But there is a point where Count Rostov would happily, or perhaps I should say unhappily, have thrown himself from that roof. He needs to take a decision about whether that will be his ending or whether he can find a future. And then, tactfully, without describing the interior process that Count Rostov goes through, we have a gap and a new section begins. And at the beginning of the new section, we find that he has indeed found a role for himself, not one that you would expect of an aristocrat, but something which gives meaning to his life, uses his already existing talents of being able to seat people very appropriately so that nobody quarrels and people have plenty to say to one another. And his tact and his knowledge of food and fine dining, he becomes the head waiter in the prestigious Metropole Hotel, the Boyarsky Restaurant.
And there he has colleagues. He has the chef, and the third person in this triumvirate is...
it's the maître d' called André.
They've known each other for a long time because he's lived in this hotel for many years, I think. So he's very comfortable in there. But as you say, he's now found a role. It's not that he needs to work for money because he's actually got quite a lot of wealth with him. He's not actually poor.
No.
Not struggling for
he's
money.
He's not poor in terms of money, but money. Maybe in terms of everything else at the beginning.
Yes, yes. Yeah. The one thing he would find very difficult is to be isolated. As you say, he creates a role for himself, or has found a role, at a time when all sorts of strange things are happening, aren't they? Because this is, after all, we are now moving through the 20s and into the 30s. This is the Soviet Union establishing itself as a totalitarian state. Stalin is in control, or as he's nicknamed So-So, which is not one I'd come across before. And it's becoming that very intense workers' proletariat with odd meetings that are going on in the ballroom where you bring together the management of the tractor associations of the Soviet Union or something equally absurd. And all these things are going on. And there's a context underneath this all the time, which is that we're passing through different phases of history. The book, in fact, goes from the time before the First World War and before the Revolution. But this tale of Rostov, as we know it, is from the 20s through the 30s, 40s, through the Second World War and into the 50s. So what you've actually got there is a history book underlying very much a person-driven narrative and a character that's tremendous in the variety that he brings to us. I think I found him fascinating in that urbanity, that suave experience. And yet there are several surprises that he encounters on the way, aren't there? There are lots of different things that he's not used to.
It's clear that you already understand the history of the Soviet Union. If I don't, I know merely that one revolution followed another and that there were constant changes of regime and you would be in one minute and out and sent to Siberia the next. And we see a degree of that. And there are actually sort of witty footnotes which tell us a bit more. We kind of see the manifestation within the metropole, within this closed microcosm of the metropole, in what's happening and what's asked of the count. So when he first starts being head waiter, there is a representative of the Communist Party within the hotel, nicknamed the Bishop because of his lugubrious manner. And he insists that all the labels are taken off the wine so that nobody, specifically the count, can't boast of their knowledge of fine wines. And everybody becomes like the proletariat. The proletariat is the right way to be. And I notice that by the end of the book, that a party official is coming in, instead of trying to make the count more like the proletariat, he is asking the count to explain to him fine manners and comportment so that he may behave more like an aristocrat. So we see the, I guess, the corruption from the original mission of the Communist Party in that. So we're tracking that. In parallel with that, there's the dilapidation of the Metropole Hotel, just the occasional reference to threadbare carpets and economies that are being made and repairs that are being made. And we track as well through the occasional references to the count's exercise routine every morning, how there were way more squat thrusts at the beginning of the novel than there are by the end. In fact, I'm not sure there are any. I think that might be a little too vigorous by the end of the novel when Count Rostov is nearing 60. And alongside that, the most fascinating thing of all, however, I think, is the count's character development. When you look for meaning in a novel, you go, well, maybe it gives us a picture of the communist regime, maybe it does this, maybe it does that. But always key to a novel's success is whether there's some character development. And that's very much the case with Count Rostov. So we hear stories about his past and we see how he behaves at the beginning of his internment. And several times the word smug or smugly is used in connection with him. He is fortunate enough to have been brought up with education, wealth, and one imagines him also to be good looking and charming. And he takes for granted these advantages and slightly looks down his nose at anybody who has them, which is how he falls into trouble with the bishop. There's another whole incident, which is too long to report, where he falls foul of an officer of cavalry who later on comes back to blight his family because of the way Count Rostov dealt with him smugly. So we need to see Count Rostov moving out of that. And as he grasps his role and works to the advantage of all in the restaurant, and as around him, the workers who originally were his servants, I think he was always on friendly terms with them, treated them well, was scrupulously polite, but they actually become much more like his family and his best friends as the novel goes on through. And he comes to value them as equals. In all this, we see his character developing.
We talked about Andrei, the maitre d', and the head chef. And when the three of them get together, they create the most perfect of the old dishes that they used to know in the old days.
At 1 a.m, the conspirators took their seats. On the table before them were a single candle, a loaf of bread, a bottle of rosé, and 3 bowls of bouillabaisse. After exchanging a glance, the three men dipped their spoons into the stew in unison. But for Emil, the gesture was a sleight of hand. For when Andrei and the count raised their spoons to their mouths, Emil let his hover above the bowl, intent upon studying his friend's expressions at the very first taste. Fully aware that he was being watched, the count closed his eyes to attend more closely to his impressions. How to describe it? One first tastes the broth, that simmered distillation of fish bones, fennel, and tomatoes, with their hearty suggestions of Provence. One then savours the tender flakes of haddock, and the briny resilience of the mussels, which have been purchased on the docks from the fishermen. One marvels at the boldness of the oranges arriving from Spain, and the absinthe poured in the taverns. And all of these various impressions are somehow collected, composed, and brightened by the saffron, that essence of summer sun, which, having been harvested in the hills of Greece and packed by mule to Athens, has been sailed across the Mediterranean in a felucca. In other words, with the very first spoonful, one finds oneself transported to the port of Marseille, where the streets teem with sailors, thieves, and Madonnas, with sunlight and summer, with languages and life. The Count opened his eyes. Magnifique, he said. André, who had put down his spoon, brought his elegant hands together in a respectful show of silent applause. Beaming, the chef bowed to his friends and then joined them in their long-awaited meal.
These characters develop as well over time because we are dealing with 30-plus years of history and people grow older during that time. I think it's the chef, I can't remember the chef or the maitre d', as they get older, they get physically weaker. You know, ailments afflict them, which is absolutely true to life. It's not just him, although he's the central character and you can't get away from him. And I found him fascinating in lots of different ways. And I was sort of thinking, it's very English in many ways because we're used to the aristocracy. Of course, the Russian aristocracy was probably very similar to the British aristocracy, so there are probably lots of links there. There are other people that come in. I mean, you talked about the actress that he has this occasional affair with, if you can put it that way, when she turns up. And she goes through a history of her own because the world outside in Russia, Soviet Union, was very tricky. You had to make sure you didn't say the wrong thing at the wrong time, particularly under the rule of Stalin. But there are others. There's a child that comes into his life. In fact, he has to look after her.
He is certainly by that stage old to be the father of a young child.
That's right.
But he isn't the father of the young child. He is acting as the godfather of the young child. Yes. A great deal of humour is drawn from that because for all his many accomplishments, playing with a little girl is not one of them. And gently, the people around him with whom he works instruct him in games and activities that might make a child happy, and he learns to nurture this other little human being and to raise her. And in fact, we see that as he behaves well and wins through his circumstances, he's blessed with a family of sorts. It's not a conventional family, but he grows to have a child and very good friends who are like brothers and sisters to him. I think that is one of the crowning points, that you see that he has succeeded in becoming a nicer person and a useful person, and that is success measured in very different terms than it would have been before the revolution, I guess.
I give up, he said. Without a hint of gloating, Sophia accepted his surrender. Then she jumped off her chair and walked toward him. He stepped a little out of her way, assuming that she must have hid the thimble somewhere in the bookcase. But she didn't approach the bookcase. Instead, she stopped in front of him, reached into his jacket pocket, and withdrew the thimble. The Count was aghast. In fact, he actually sputtered. But, Sophia, that's not fair. Sophia studied the Count with curiosity. Why is it not fair? Always with that damnable why. Because it's not, replied the Count. But you said we could hide it anywhere in the room. That's just it, Sophia. My pocket wasn't in the room. Your pocket was in the room when I hid the thimble, and it was in the room when you hunted. And as the Count gazed into her innocent little face, it all became clear. He, a master of nuance and sleight of hand, had been played at every turn. When she had called him back to insist he not peek, and had so sweetly tugged at his sleeve, that was a ploy to mask the slipping of the thimble into his pocket. And the moving of the furniture, as the 200th second approached, pure theatre, a ruthless case of dissembling, and even as he searched, there she sat, clutching her little dolly in its bright blue dress, without ever once betraying her wiles. The Count took one step back and bowed at the waist.
I think it's a lovely book, and I found the ending quite charming, quite surprising, and obviously we're not going to talk about it.
I think one of the problems with this book is that I certainly was disposed to fall utterly in love with Count Rostov, and I imagine many readers will be. I believe there are plans to televise it. It will be a very hard set of shoes to fill, to be Count Rostov. I heard people dismiss it because it's witty and appears to be light and charming, but it's asking a lot of questions about values, about what actually matters to us, what is civilization, what do we need to persist, what do we need to still be us, how do we need to move on? And I think under cover of a very witty, urbane, erudite set of prose, which is a pleasure to read, it is asking serious questions.
Thank you very much, Claire.
Thank you, Rob.
We now come to part three, an article from Hearts Life about direct action on climate change. Read by Sue.
In this feature from Hertfordshire Life, Louise McAvoy speaks to Amanda King. From Hearts County Councillor to arrested climate protester, Amanda is one of the growing number of normally law-abiding people eschewing to regular politics for direct action. It's called an ordinary rebel. When the house is on fire, the normal rules don't apply. It's not a crime to break a window to save those inside. This is the maxim of environmental activist group Extinction Rebellion, and it's used by former Hertfordshire County Councillor Amanda King to explain how she came to be arrested during the movement's London protests in October. The charity worker, who has lived in Stevenage since 1969, is no stranger to activism, having joined the Stevenage Labour Party at the age of 14, participating in door knocks and leaflet drops with a youthful optimism that hasn't waned over the years. Despite repeatedly hitting brick walls when it comes to meaningful action over environmental issues. I was increasingly concerned about the environment as a teenager, the 61-year-old explains. Acid rain, groundwater pollution, and damage to the ozone layer were just some of the environmental issues which were defined in the 1970s and 80s. But Amanda says they didn't get any political traction. The environmental groups were single-issue groups that didn't come together as a national organisation with a clear set of demands, which is why Extinction Rebellion is so wonderful and so timely, she adds. Extinction Rebellion is a global environmental movement formed in October 2018 to elicit change in the face of an unprecedented climate emergency. Amanda has been a member of the group since the beginning, having become increasingly frustrated with the three main political parties in the UK. The climate emergency is an issue that all political parties say they're addressing, she says. But if you look at the small print, they're not. Plans to make the UK carbon neutral by 2050 shows they don't understand the science or the severity of the issue. The UN has published a report compiled by the world's leading climate scientists saying we have 12 years to get to grips with the climate change. Beyond that, the future is unknown because there are too many things that could go radically wrong. Amanda was a Hertfordshire County Council member from 2013 to 2017, representing the old Stevenage division, but stepped down due to increasing frustration over the limitations of the role. The way to create change is to be involved in groups with a clear agenda and not aligned to any organisation in power, she insists. When we are independent of power, we have a much more powerful voice. Extinction Rebellion is something a lot of us have been waiting for a long time. Thankfully, it's happening because we are running out of time. So how does the movement propose to change? Extinction Rebellion has three demands: that the government tells the truth about the environmental crisis, that the government legislates to commit to becoming carbon neutral by 2025, and lastly, that a UK Citizens' Assembly is formed to guide how the government tackles the climate emergency. It's a societal problem. We're all stuck in the same system that is attacking our Earth, but the government can create fast-acting change and get us out of this. In November last year, Amanda joined Extinction Rebellion in blockading the five bridges across the Thames in London and was arrested during the group's protests in October after obstructing Lombard Street in the city. She says, "I had decided it was important to be one of the people to stand up and be counted on such an important issue. I was ready to be arrested that day. There were three of us lying down in the road holding hands. I was looking at a little bit of blue sky surrounded by police officers. The arresting officer gave me 20 minutes to think about it. And in that time, trained Extinction Rebellion volunteers were supporting us. Amanda was eventually handcuffed and taken into custody at Brixton Police Station, where she was detained for 7 hours before being released on bail. I was in a state of shock," she said. "For all of us, this was the first time we had been arrested in our lives. We were law-abiding, peaceful citizens. Facing arrest is the risk you take, but I felt it was the principled, necessary thing to do. The Metropolitan Police Service says the protest cost the force £24 million and led to 1,828 arrests, with 165 people charged with offences. Responding to critics of Extinction Rebellion's actions, Amanda says it's a peaceful organisation interested only in direct, non-violent action. Our purpose is to disrupt in a peaceful way, to bring to light the emergency we are facing. I commend the police. I appreciate that they were only doing their jobs. But it's reached a point where ordinary people feel like they need to take this sort of action. Normal politics isn't working. What is a person of conscience supposed to do? I've been part of meetings, protests and petitions for years, and it hasn't achieved real action. Look at what Extinction Rebellion has achieved. The environmental crisis has gone to the top of the political agenda. What we have achieved in such a short space of time should give us hope. There are Extinction Rebellion groups across Hertfordshire, including St Albans, Letchworth, Ware, Tring and Berkhamsted. And Amanda has now set up a group in Stevenage, with its first meeting held in November and its first action, a protest as a consultation on the proposed expansion of Luton Airport, held at Stevenage Arts and Leisure Centre in December. Amanda is also calling on Stevenage Borough Council, which she says has a history of being visionary, to be more ambitious with its plans to become carbon neutral by adopting more imaginative schemes, such as a workplace parking charges and a bike hire scheme. She's also imploring the council not to approve new roads or wider roads or to stop supporting the expansion of Luton Airport. While this is a global issue and a national issue that government must act on, she says, the climate and ecological crisis is happening in Hertfordshire as well. Each person's carbon footprint in this area is 5.2 tonnes per year, when it should be 1.2 tonnes. Key species and the countryside we love are in crisis, even though it's hard to see it because it's happening slowly. I live in a council flat in Stevenage, and in the mornings over the summer I would hear the birds cheeping, and it was like an orchestra. Now, 20 years later, I'm in the same flat and I only count 3 or 4 bird species. If you're not paying attention, you can think there isn't a crisis. The devastation of species of bees and butterflies is happening here in our county. In Stevenage, there is black dust in the air that comes from cars and aircraft. I'll wipe my outside table, and within a few days it will be covered in dust. Amanda, however, refuses to give up hope and is optimistic about the future. Things are definitely changing, she said, and ordinary people are now aware of the issues. As people become more informed, they will demand that politicians take meaningful action. Our society has got itself into such a mess, but I'm still positive and I refuse to feel deflated. I refuse to feel terrified. It's an emergency, but there's still time. And the existing technologies are there to become carbon neutral within the next 12 years. It's a matter of political will.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks, as ever, to all our contributors, including our readers, Caroline, Kelly, Bob, and Anne. And as ever, thank you for listening. Rob will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in February 2020. We close with Barakoa by the AKA Trio. I hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.